Apart from that, it's been fine. I haven't really left the house. I ran over to the shop at one point, and that was about it.
Yeah, you're having a less eventful one than me. I've had an awful Friday the 13th. I had a dog follow me to work today. Now, I mean, from my front door, literally to my desk. Security had to hunt him out.
Jeez.
Yeah. And also, I chipped a tooth, which...
Oh, no.
Yeah. And now it's the worst part about it is, right? I'm not vain. So, like, if I chipped a tooth, I wouldn't be worried about how it'd look. But it's, like, the back of one of my bottom teeth, like, It doesn't look chipped from the front, but it's definitely okay. Chipped on, like, would say the second layer on the back. So now every time I talk and every time I move my tongue, I can feel that little sharp edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I think I'm due a trip to the dentist now because it's quite sore.
So Friday the 13th is real for you.
Yeah, no, that shit is real. Yeah. No, this is the first time I've had a bad experience on Friday the 13th. But hey, look, we'll see how the rest of the day goes. Like, knowing my luck now, I'll get electrocuted because I've got a bottle of wine with me tonight. I'm drinking a Cabernet Sauvignon, Coonawarra from Australia, 2020. Good year for wine. Not so much for the rest of the world.
No.
Good evening, good morning, good night, depending on where you are in the world. Tis I, your fine host for this evening's affair, where we will delve into a decade like no other. A decade where pretty much everything is remembered due to the curse that is social media. So to join me in this journey of post-traumatic stress, the only man who Colleen Rooney doesn't have blocked on Instagram, the man who runs into the DUP offices and shouts, "Ha, now you know how it feels," and runs like hell. It's Simon Chadwick.
Hey, Kieran, how you getting on?
All good. I'm trying to keep it relevant as we get closer.
Very topical. Yeah.
I know, right? Yeah, I've been watching a lot of news lately. So, yes, we're about to kick off, I suppose, the last run of our show here, which is kind of, as I have written here, so we're kicking off this year, obviously, with 2010, and now the end is near, and so we face the final decade. So it's coming to a close. But we open up this week probably the most iconic footage of all time ever broadcast on Irish television. Man falling on ice. It's just so iconic, isn't it?
It is. And it was like, if you remember, because obviously this decade they're about to cover, these episodes were released just over a year ago. I think it was kind of April time last year, if I remember correctly. And there was a big like debate about what the first scene would be in this, the first episode of the latest series of Ruling in the Years. And a lot of people did call that. They were like, you have to, if man slipping on ice isn't in this episode, we riot. You know, we're going out to John O'Regan's house, we're burning them out. Like, this is like, he's got to be in there. And, you know, the people asked, the people got. And actually, just on a side note around this whole decade and this whole series, there are a lot of different things that we're going to see. Because they're so long between series, you know, RTE and John O'Regan have a long time to kind of listen to people's opinions. So it's unlike any other show like this, where there's actually a lot of different things in this decade and in each decade, because they're able to listen and digest and plan and actually come up with stuff. So, for example, you know, that's an example, a minor example of kind of people wanted that clip in the episode. And it was always going to be the episode. But for example, we'll see more like women's sport, which has never been shown before. It's not in this episode, but it's coming up, you know, and things like that. So we'll point them out as they go on. But yeah, this was definitely one that got a little bit of a push on social media. And he very much started with a bang.
Absolutely. And you know, I was only thinking about that actually when you know earlier on about the whole women's sport issue, and I didn't actually cop it, but they're actually in the intro. There is a sort of a nod to women's sport. I think it's the women's Irish hockey team. I could be wrong.
That's right. It is, yeah.
So we get, but you're right. No, they certainly do. They do listen, especially when it came to man slipping on ice. I believe, if I'm right in saying, I could be wrong. I believe it's Dublin, obviously, but you know Dublin more than I do. I don't know where the street is, but apparently there's a placard there. I don't know if it's still there. It was there. I think it was paid for by Waterford Whispered News or a beer company, I want to say.
I didn't know that, actually.
No, yeah. Let me see if I can find that, actually. I should have taken a picture of it.
Yeah, I don't know where that was, actually. Man slipping on ice, Ireland, is the first thing when you type man slipping into Google, obviously. Church Street, near the forecourts. Okay, yeah, not really my
Now, the placard does say, and it was put up, it looks, by Coors Light. of all people. It says, in honour of, and in a parentheses, the guy who slipped on the ice on RT News, January 8th, 2010, your memory lives on.
Yeah, and I like as well, like this guy, I love it because he has managed to remain totally anonymous.
Oh,
I don't think anyone has ever kind of come out and been like, oh, it was me. And possibly they don't even, I mean, I guess they would know, but maybe they don't know. Like maybe it's not someone who watches the news and therefore actually doesn't know that they were in this because you never see their face or anything, just the back of the guy.
Yeah.
And then he slips on the ice. And obviously far from the only person to ever have done that, but probably the only person, we assume, to have been caught on RT News.
There was a guy who did claim that it was him, and he did look like the guy, and he made a YouTube video about how he fails to do everyday things. So because, like, you know, the whole point of the video is like, you know, he's taking the piss, obviously, and it's obviously not him.
Yeah.
But the whole point of the video being, you know, he struggles to do everyday things and people shouldn't make fun of him for it. So, like, you know, he's at his computer and like he goes to type something and he falls off his chair and goes on for like 10 minutes. It's not great. It's kind of like somebody trying to cash in on a joke. So this was a result of the big freeze that year. Temperatures dropped to minus 16 in some parts. As Michael Sands tells us, that's a once in a 50-year event. I obviously a lot of stuff we're going to see in these next couple of episodes. I remember, I'm sure you do, but do you remember kind of where you were or what situation you were in during the big freeze?
I do remember this, yeah, because it was early January. Obviously, that guy slipped on the ice on January 8th, but I remember New Year's, or the week before that, we effectively got snowed in. I was living at home at the time where I grew up, where my parents live in Enniskerry. Enniskerry is obviously, it's quite high up, it's like elevated, and we live up the back, so like you go through the village and up a big hill called Kilgarran Hill, which becomes pretty impassable on really cold in cold snaps, because they do grid it now, but back then the council didn't come out and grid the road, even back in like 2010. So once that hill froze over, it was essentially impossible to drive up or down it unless you were quite skilled at it. So I remember getting snowed in on New Year's, and I was supposed to be going down to Bray to meet all my friends and my then girlfriend and all the rest of it, you know, as a 19-year-old or 20-year-old at the time. So I remember walking through the snow from my house in Enniskerry to the back bar, which was the nightclub in Bray at the time. Took about, I don't know, 2 hours just to get out and have a few beers.
Not
spend New Year's Eve at my parents, who I'm sure were probably in a neighbor's house or something. I don't know. But
that's
my memory. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that relationship ended shortly after, even though I walked in the snow for 2 hours to meet her for New Year's. It was probably more of the points, to be fair.
Yeah,
but, I remember that. And I remember it being snowy and icy for so long.
Yeah, it went on for quite a while, because funny enough, I actually have a, not similar, but I was going out with a girl at the time as well, and we hadn't been going out together like that long, like at all. I mean, a couple of weeks, and I was staying over in her parents' house. I was on a night out and I stayed over in her parents' house, but they live in like literally the back arse of nowhere, Tremor, and they've got like a steep driveway. So I got stuck there without a change of clothes for like 6 days. It sucked donkey balls. It was awful. And like every day her dad would get in the Jeep and try to rev the Jeep up over the ramp, and I would be like praying, please let me, because you could not walk. Like Tremor, it's out in Tremor, but like Tremor is not that far, as in like on a regular day you could totally walk it, but with the snow and the ice I would have died. So like every day he'd try and rev the Jeep up to get it over that ramp, because he said if he could get me over the hill then I'd be able to go home. And it just wasn't happening. So like 6 days in the same fucking clothes. It was awful. And another cataclysmic weather events, a volcano in Iceland erupts, which causes a gigantic ash cloud to form and completely cover the skies of most of Europe. As a result, flights are grounded and cancelled, as we see a very disappointed hen party and one man who seems enthusiastically disappointed, if that makes sense. This guy was like, his eyes were popping out of his head. He was like, a volcano of all things, you couldn't imagine it. Like,
yeah, that guy was hilarious. He was like, we're after coming. I mean, it's madness. And you're just like, he's just, if I could have imagined someone from Leitrim, it would be this guy. He's kind of got a square haircut and like those eyes popping out of his head. And just the big thing, like he's come up to Dublin and now he just can't I don't even know if he was in Dublin. It looked like he was in London. But anyway, he's like, I mean, you couldn't imagine it. You couldn't credit it. I just imagine this guy could be a seasoned traveler. But to me, he was just like, this is his first time out of Leitrim. And he's just aghast and kind of relieved that he's not able to go anywhere.
Because of the ash cloud. Back to Leitrim. I remember this so clearly just because of the fact that around the time I was still watching wrestling, and they still had to put on Monday Night Raw, but they had like three people there because the European tour got stuck and the flights got cancelled, etc. So
I do remember that.
Yeah. It's I think they had like a match between Sheamus and somebody else. Triple H was the referee and CM Punk was the commentator, and that was it. The rest of the night was like a best of. And I used to stay up till 1 a.m. to watch that shit. up next, a young, fresh-faced Leo was throwing some shit at Enda, saying, people have said they don't have confidence in Enda Kenny. Can we see these people? No. As Enda gears up for a battle for the crown as leader of Fine Gael against Richard Bruton, he of course knocks out the competition and remains leader, because who the hell wants to put Richard Bruton in charge?
Yeah, and this is before Richard Bruton revealed his sexy abs.
Stupid sexy Bruton.
This is before we knew how sexy the man was. This is gas. I mean, I remember this, and I guess you have to remember that Enda Kenny had been leader of Fine Gael for 8 years at this point, and had really achieved very little in terms of, like, they'd obviously made gains when Fianna Fáil and the coalition hit the walls after the recession hit, but I guess this was kind of them saying, well, we're probably going to win the election in 2011, which was the next general election. Well, it was due to be 2012, but it ended up being in 2011, so they were probably looking at it going, we're going to be probably in government in a couple of years, and who do we want leading us? Like, Enda, even at this point, was old. You know, like, he'd been around a long time. At this point, he's the old, certainly after the 2011 election, he's the eldest. The father of the doll, or the grandfather of the doll, whatever they call it, the oldest person in the oldest TD. So I guess they're probably looking, people like Bradker were probably looking at it and saying, you know, get rid of Enda, let Bruton take the reins for a couple of years. Obviously, it worked out for Bradker, because in the end, Kenny got his couple of years as Taoiseach, and then the economy steadied, and then he went off to ride the rails and became Leo, you know. So it actually ended up working out for Bradker. He didn't seem to be damaged by his blatant lack of support in Enda Kenny.
No, but how do you face a man like that, though? You know what I mean? That's like, it's like being called into a meeting where your boss is also there, and you're talking shit to your boss's boss about your boss, and you're like, look, I just don't have any confidence in my boss. And then they keep your boss on the payroll, and he or she is still your boss. And then you have to go to work with them. You know, you're scrubbing toilets for a week. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, this was a real, like, this was very Fine Gael. They were all kind of a bit too friendly, and nobody fell out. And nobody suffered. Like, bring back the Haughey leadership challenges where he had his minions were rounding up TDs and berating them into voting for him. Like, bring that back. Like,
bring back berating. I love it. And of course, across the pond in politics, Alive Mike catches Gordon Brown talking shit about his constituents as one woman is taking him to task on immigrants. He says on the sly she's a bigoted woman. And then we, of course, see David Cameron and his deadly wife as they're seen strolling around as he takes the lead for UK with the Tories back in Downing Street for the first time in 13 years. Two things. This definitely did not help Gordon Brown in the slightest. And that woman definitely was a bigot, by the way. But also, I forgot how fucking good looking David Cameron's wife was. She is
heavily pregnant here, by the way, or else.
Okay, well, pregnant. Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, that still, they look pregnant people are good looking. That's
exactly
not
it.
I mean, like, considering he fucks pigs, like, that's doing well. Like, he's doing very well there with his perfectly normal looking wife.
And we mean that literally, by the way. Like, we're, you know, for anybody who's completely out of the loop, no, he literally confessed to having sex with a pig.
We can't even be sued for that. That is true. I remember thinking, Gordon Brown at the time, this was a big thing, like, that Brown had said this, like, and got caught saying this. And, like, nowadays, obviously, people get caught saying stuff because social media 24/7, people are like being filmed. But, like, she was a bigot. Now you look at it and go, well, he was right. Like, and unfortunately, her type are now essentially running England and running the UK. Like, you know, and that's the problem now. Like, you know, we saw in the last decade and, you know, the start of the decline of the US with Bush coming in and, you know, the kind of the more, you know, the election 2000 and all the shenanigans and all that. And we're now you know, we're now at a stage where their Congress was invaded by a bunch of, you know, whatever lunatics. Yeah. And, you know, the UK is going down that path, and you can trace it probably to this, the turmoil after you know, Blair left, and, you know, Brown coming in, he was never particularly popular. And the and there's a mirroring here of, like, you know, Labour getting turfed out, and obviously Fianna Fáil are going to get turfed out in Ireland a year later, you know, and it's very, it's all very similar, and in the other guys, and, you know, they're still there, you know, and I know Fianna Fáil are back in Ireland, but, like, Labour are a long way from coming back over there.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. The only example that I could really think about in terms of Gordon Brown getting caught on a hot mic is Gabbo from The Simpsons. You know, all the kids in Springfield are SOBs.
Oh yeah.
He's like, bigoted woman, what? there was actually a similar instance actually a couple of years ago. Now, you can debate how scripted it may or may not have been, but on when The Apprentice was a thing on TV in the States, and they were tasked with running a restaurant, and these two old fat ladies were giving out stink to one of the contestants about how her restaurant has been run or some shit, and on the side the camera picked her up and filmed and put it out there, her turning to, like, you know, whoever was overseeing the task and going, I just can't satisfy those fat old Jewish ladies, and then the whole play, you know, the whole production was like, it was broadcast, and everybody's like, you can't say that, and the two ladies were like, no, we are fat and old and Jewish, we just took offense to it. It's like, well, yeah, all right, I suppose it's the term, the context, really. But yeah, words to the wise, if you're going to be you know, talking shit, make sure your microphone is off. By the way, I'm just going to cut there, all our listeners are SOBs, son. Anyway, so up next, Charlie Bird travels all the way to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and knocks on the door of former Anglo CEO David Drum. He asks Mr. Drum if he'll come out and play or talk or whichever suits, but instead David Drum decides to hide behind the sofa, and eventually tells Bird to piss off. It's also in other breaking news and banking news, Sean Fitzpatrick is quizzed by the Gardaí but later acquitted of all charges against him. We'll touch on that in a second. But David Drum hiding, why Charlie Bird looking in the window going, why are you crouching down?
This is great TV. I don't know until I saw this last year on this episode, I didn't know, I hadn't seen this. I 100% had no recollection of it. I don't think I would have seen it at the time. I don't know, was it on, like, did he make a documentary about going to find David Drum? Was it just on the news? But, like, this is I mean, Charlie Bird, we talk all day about Charlie Bird. He's doing great things at the minute, obviously, in an awful situation. But this is him at his best. Like, he just doorsteps the man. but what I love about it is that David Drum, did you not see the sign on the door? And I'm like, or the gate. And I'm like, what did that sign say? Because Charlie wasn't hanging around. Charlie was like,
no birds.
I just want to talk to you. And he's like, Charlie, that sign. And Charlie's like, right, I'm gone. So I'm like, 100%, because he's in America, so I just have to assume that it was like, trespassers will be shot, and that Drum is brandishing like a handgun at him from behind the sofa, just like waving a gun at him as if he'd ever used a bloody thing. But this is hilarious TV. But just goes to show, I mean, these guys, like, you know, I mean, Charlie Bird was right. Charlie Bird is saying, you know, there's people at home who want answers. And, you know, as much as I don't think with a lot of these guys and you know, they were demonized in a lot of ways, the banking execs, because obviously they're on big salaries and like, they made big mistakes. The system allowed them to do it. So, like, it's not, they weren't technically doing anything. Sorry, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, they weren't technically doing anything wrong as they saw it. But obviously, like, it's, you know, there's an opinion that says it's wrong. And, that, you know, public opinion says, you know, you were gambling with money that wasn't yours, etc. But at the same time, they did have a duty when shit hit the fan to suffer with. And there's so many of these execs in these big financial companies that they go, they've got homes in other countries and they just go, and they're not in, but, you know, they're trying to stay out of the way and keep the head down. And, like, you know, I know David Drum he's had court cases and stuff like that. And there was issues. I think David Drum was the guy who had transferred a load of stuff into his wife's name, if I'm not mistaken.
Could be. Yeah. That does ring a bell.
You know, Charlie was doing, and RTE were doing, as they probably saw it, a public public service, you know. I think Drum was convicted, wasn't he? Drum was convicted of fraud. So I'm not saying that he was, you know, he didn't do anything wrong, but just in general, you know, there was these things. But he moved his family to Massachusetts, I guess because the US also don't convict him or don't look too shabbily on people. And you know, yeah, it's just, but this is, yeah, I just couldn't stop laughing at this when I was like, I did not read the sign on the door, on the gate. And I'm like, what did the sign say, Charlie? Tell me, I need to know. But he never tells.
Yeah.
And then Charlie walks away and goes, he's in there. I'm like, yeah, we know he's in there.
The sign definitely said like no birds. And Charlie went, yeah, but you have a parrot in there. It says no birds. We're allowed to have one. No Charlie birds. So tell me, Sean Fitzpatrick, popular name over the last 10, 12 years. So what were these charges that were brought against him? Why was he acquitted? What did he do wrong? What did he do right?
Yeah, Sean, he fits. Look, let me tell you about Sean Fitzpatrick, right? I'll let you in on a little more background on my life. I feel like I just come on and talk about myself.
Well, to be fair, this episode is very finance heavy.
It is in this era. So Sean Fitzpatrick, right, is a former student of my old school, Presentation College in Bray. And when I was in school, it was pre-crash. So I was in Pres from 2001 to 2007, right? So I left summer 2007, which happened shortly after that, right? And the reason I say that is because I was in... I did accountancy, and the teacher was a gas man, but he was the kind of teacher, he'd be like, lads, you need to work hard, you need to get your A's, and you'll be like Sean Fitzpatrick, best student I ever had. And he just hammered on about Seanie Fitz and what a great man he's. Now he's the chief, look at him, he was in this little school in Bray, and now he's chief executive of one of the biggest banks in Ireland. He's great. Y'all want to be like Seanie Fitz. And like, this is like, you know, this is only a couple of years later, and we're all watching him get arrested in Greystones and taken to the local guard station, which is Bray, which is like right down from the school. I was like, I wonder what Mr. Ryan, our old accountancy teacher. So I'd say he stopped telling students to be like Seanie Fitz fairly soon after. But I have a somewhat of a personal connection. I don't know the man, but by all accounts, actually, personally, a very nice guy, Sean Fitzpatrick. He would have, one of my friends would have worked in the golf club that he was a member of, and said he was always very nice to the staff, which, you know, not everyone is, and not everyone in positions of power are. Anyway, what was he charged with, Kieran, you asked? The guards got a warrant to search the house. And really he was just arrested for questioning around, it's a technical thing, but basically because he ran Anglo-Irish, right? And Anglo-Irish was his business, and he was running it and looking for it to be to get investment into it. I explained last week about NAMA taking the debt away and then making Anglo-Irish more viable to be sold or to be invested in and try and get money back into it. But the bank was insolvent. Technically, it was illegal at the time for him to try and sell it. So that was kind of the reason they did it, but it was a little bit, it was more really of a publicity stunt, in as much as, you know, they could be seen to be taking action and arresting these guys, because at the time there was a big, we'll see the protest later, big groundswell of public opinion that, you know, these bankers and these people should be paying the penalties now that, you know, Ireland had bailed out the banks and the taxpayer was on the hook for it. You know, they, people wanted to see justice. They didn't really have a huge amount to arrest them for at the time, but it was kind of like flimsy enough reasoning, but it was enough to question them for 24 hours, search the house. And in the end, that then brought later, and we'll see it in, I think, next week's episode, a later arrest and investigation. And he was indeed charged eventually with 16 offences, I think it is, in relation to the lending and all that stuff that we've heard about from Anglo. So we'll explain that more as it goes on. But he was, in the end, acquitted of all charges. He never was convicted of anything.
Ah, okay. And speaking of being held accountable, another journalist chases another banker, as we see the head of Irish Nationwide being chased through the airport by RTE's David Murphy, who asks if he has any remorse for what happened. He says, of course I do. And everything that can be done is being done right now. Don't mind the fact that I'm clearly heading off on a golfing trip.
L. Fingers, Michael Fingleton, there is man, right?
Fingers.
Yeah, that's what he was nicknamed, right? So Fingers was... I mean, clearly heading off to the Bahamas or somewhere, like, right? He's like, you know, come on, like, Clearly going off. And this is what I'm talking about, is these guys were just leaving the country and they were still going about their lives, their wealthy lives, going to their holiday homes in, and we're not talking about holiday homes in Kilkee here, like we're talking about holiday homes in the Bahamas, in Cape Cod. Well, actually David Drummond moved there, but that's, you know, but like you're talking about this. I mean, Michael Fingledon was you know, a regular Joe who, like, you know, joined the bank and worked his way up and got rich on the boom, you know, and that's where he came from. It's, he wasn't someone who was of wealth. He just came into it, but like it just shows, just shows how much. And he was, I mean, I think he was paid a bonus in 2009.
Fuck.
Of €1 million.
That is not going to go down well.
Sorry, 2008. Yeah, 2008.
Jesus. And
he was entitled to it under his contract, but obviously it was like a Celtic Tiger deal, and realistically he should not have taken that €1 million. This is why your man was chasing around the airport. I think he offered, it said on the notes I read yesterday, that he offered to give it to charity, but the government actually rejected that, and there was no, like, because they were saying just return it to the bank, like the bank needs the money, or Irish Nation, but he never did, by all accounts.
Ah, bastard. I could imagine him on his plane, you know, like coming, like the pilot comes over the intercom on the way to the Bahamas. Ladies and gentlemen, we're making an unscheduled stop in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Where have I heard that name before? Charlie Bird in the airport. Yeah, look at him. There he is, 37A. What are you crouching down?
Charlie Bird hiding behind those drivers with the signs that have the names on it.
Fake mustache.
Fingers, it's Charlie Bird here.
Oh, bollocks, keep going.
Answer the nation.
And in Leitrim, A.B. Huberman and Brian O'Driscoll tie the knot. Not much to say here, but Jesus, the big smiley head on Brian, as in, like, you know, look what I did, look what I got. I genuinely always get confused between A.B. Huberman and Vogue Williams because they both have a massive mouth.
Ah, Kieran. No, A.B. Huberman is Ireland's sweetheart.
I don't know. There's something. Maybe it's the eyebrows. I don't know. There's something better I don't trust.
That's disappointed here.
What?
That's disappointing to hear. We're big Amy Huberman fans. Yeah, lovely couple, by all accounts. Still together, which is nice for celebrities.
They are, you know,
12 years later. And a couple, I think they have 3 kids. I don't remember this being big news.
Low-key celebrity, you know, low-key celebrity wedding kind of thing.
It's no Westlife wedding in France.
No, it's in Leitrim instead, which we've had a very...
Leitrim's second mention in this episode.
I was just about to say, a very Leitrim-y episode. And you know what? I met somebody last week at a 30th birthday party, and he was from Leitrim. And that's the first person I've ever met from Leitrim.
I was going to say, did we have a conversation on a previous episode about how we didn't know people from Leitrim?
Yes, we did. And we said that it was a conspiracy theory, or it was a tax haven for people from Roscommon or something.
Well, there you go. Now we've met a Leitrim man who... admittedly lived up to the stereotype, and we've seen a wedding allegedly take place in Leitrim.
Hey, exactly. Now, I mean, it could all be a ruse, but hey, who's to know? We'll have to take a trip to Leitrim sometime just to see if it really does exist, or if it's like the Bermuda Triangle. You get as far as Roscommon and your car just randomly turns around.
Hey, look, if someone will give us a paying gig, we will go anyway.
Absolutely. This year also sees the opening of the Aviva Stadium as John Delaney wanks himself off over how great he is. The FA I Cup final is the first game to be played at the brand new stadium. Sligo Rovers beat Shamrock Rovers to win the cup. I don't know if you watched the YouTube version, because I did, and I'm guessing for copyright reasons, the song that obviously was supposed to play over this was cut out. Did you get this too?
No, because I have the recording, so I watched the recording.
Okay, because there was no song playing over the YouTube version, so I'm guessing it got struck out. It's not really relative, but it was just weird, because where there should be music, it was just silence with clips of the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, that does happen if you find Reeling in the Years episodes on YouTube, because they'll allow the episode go up, but because certain songs, will be removed.
Yeah, I remember the Aviva being built, because I was actually working in Dublin for 2 weeks at the time, and it was just mad to see it go up so quickly.
It did.
And there's a nickname on it, isn't there? Like, and it's not the Nest. There was a weird nickname they were putting on at the time. I don't know if it stuck, but it looked like something like the cereal bowl or something. I can't remember what the hell it was. But it is by all accounts called
the toilet bowl.
That could be it.
Because it's got like, it's like those toilet seats in public toilets that don't have, like, they don't meet, you know what I mean? They're not perfect. It's like a circle. They like have two ends, like where you're...
They don't meet.
You know, if you see, you'll see them in public toilets sometimes, and they're like, it's the toilet seat, and it's like, it it's a ring at the back, but then as it comes, like it basically like doesn't meet in the front where your dangly bits might be. You know, it's just kind of open. You never seen a toilet seat like that? Well, that's what the
Avito. Now I know what you. Yeah. Like in a port-a-loo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, something like that. Right? Yeah. So that's the idea, because that it has that end that dips down. That's what it looked like or whatever.
Like a bedpan.
Yeah, it hasn't stuck. Thankfully, it is just people do call the Aviva now. Yeah. I was trying to call it Lansdowne Road.
Yeah, it's a decent enough stadium, actually, to be fair. I haven't actually been in it, but I've walked past it. So it does actually seen on the first season of Kin, by the way, for those of you who watch that.
That is the only place you will see the Aviva Stadium on your TV.
Yes.
It is. It's a good stadium. Look, it's nothing, I wouldn't say it's anything special in terms of like generating great atmospheres or like that, but I've been in some very good events at it, very good matches. Mm. And you know, it does, when people bring it on, like, you know, good Irish football match or even a rugby match on occasion, it's definitely good. It's modern and it's nice, and it's not falling apart like Lansdowne Road was. I mean, you don't have seats that are 100 years old in it, so that's good. It's all clean and modern, and I wish they would do the bar better at rugby matches, but that's really to do with the catering company, not the stadium necessarily.
And to be fair, our next segment actually brings me into the same trip that I was talking about, Dublin, for those 2 weeks, because we get upgrades to the road as the M8/M7 is complete, connecting Cork to Dublin. Now, it seems to be a look what we did, things aren't all bad type of vibe from the opening ceremony.
Oh, yeah.
The reason why I say it ties me into my trip to Dublin is because I spent 2 weeks in Kimmage and kind of the surrounding areas. And when we were coming home, we got lost in the car and we ended up taking some turn off and ended up going onto an unfinished section of the new, what was to be the new motorway. It was literally just brand new, and then just a dirt road. And at the very top of that dirt road, because we pulled over the car and we were like, shit, we're lost. And I got out of the car and I was looking around and I was like, okay, where the fuck are we? And all of a sudden, I shit you not, a chicken crossed the road at the top of that dirt road. And the guy I was with, right, I'm not going to do an impression of a Nigerian accent, but this guy that I was with was from Nigeria, and he got out of the car, he saw what I saw, and he went, what is this, a joke? And then we got back in the car and turned around. And that was like the greatest dry humor joke I've ever witnessed. It's just one of those random things that you remember. But to be fair, like, I mean, God, I remember years and years ago my dad bringing me to matches up in Crow Park, and the places that you had to stop off on the way to Dublin. It was a nightmare. It was like 3.5 hours at one point to get from Waterford to Dublin. If you're going from Cork, like if you lived in West Cork and you needed to go to north side of Dublin, you're talking easily 4.5-5 hours in the car. Whereas now, I mean, what is it, like 1.5-2 hours at most?
I think so. I think that's probably not more than that.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably get down from Dublin to Wexford like what, in about an hour?
Yeah, so like when I first started going to Camp Isle as a kid, when I first started being brought to Camp Isle, I reckon it took the guts of 3 hours. And now I think we can get there in under two.
Yeah, that's one of the best things that this government did at the time, the Fianna Fáil government. It's hilarious because Mario Rosenstock did a skit on the Mario Rosenstock show where he was Willie O'D, and he was at the end of the table standing up, but all you saw was the mustache and the head, you know, joke about Willie O'D being small. And he's like talking about Willie O'D's comeback campaign, and he hires a marketing manager, and the marketing manager showing slots is like the M7, the M8, the M1, and he's just showing slideshows, and Willie's getting excited, and he's like, oh, and then at the end of it comes up Fianna Fáil, we rode Ireland. Which is just Mario Rosenstock, one man, second funniest man to come out of Waterford, second only to me. Up next, on the Late Show, we see two lads with spar bags on their heads. This, of course, was the year we saw the rise of the Rubber Bandits, as Horse Outside is climbing the Irish charts. Ryan puts his head in his hands as if he's about to say, Pat would never have to put up with this shit.
Yeah, I remember that when Tuberty came in, he was talking about moving, not everything, but in having more light entertainment vibe to it. Like, because that's what it was originally. The late game, Pat didn't really do light entertainment, so it got quite heavy, I think. I feel like Pat always did a great line in like emotional, like,
yeah,
horrible stories. I think so much so that Apparently Match did a very good skit in one of their live shows about that, about a man who fell in love with his Hoover, which I would urge people to look at. But anyway, Tubbs gets stuck with the Rubber Bandits. I mentioned the Rubber Bandits were once rivals of my band a couple of years before. So then they suddenly got onto Republic of Telly. We're all very jealous that we hadn't carried on. Of course, we weren't trying to be a comedy band. Bebo just put us in that bracket with them. We thought we were being serious, so that's where the difference come from. But no, fair play. And who'd have thought, like in 2010, that 12 years later, that one of these guys wearing a plastic bag over his head would be one of the foremost voices in Ireland on mental health. Whatever you think about whether you agree or disagree with them, Blind Boy does keep that conversation going. Fair play to him.
Yeah, no, sorry, my mic cut out there. I couldn't hear you, but I got the latter end of what you said there. But absolutely, no, he is, I think only about a week or two ago, he actually said that he recently got the results back of a psychological assessment and he actually has autism. So he's a big advocate for that now. But the other guy, Mr. Chrome, he's more of a DJ sort of type thing, whereas Blind Boy is more the public figure behind it. I had a weird sort of relationship with the Rubber Bandits in a sense that, like, when they first came out to my attention with the Republic of Telly skits, I was like, these are fucking hilarious guys. Like, they're throwing snails at somebody's house. They're, shit like that. And I was like, this is what Irish comedy needs. Like, this is just so original. Then they brought out Horse Outside and I was like, fucking A, this is an absolute banger. Then they kept making more songs. And then I was like, yeah, these are good. These are good. And then they were everywhere. And I was like, oh, fucking hell. They're just everywhere. And then your man started his podcast. And I was like, he just seems so up his own arse. But then I kind of came back around to it. And I was like, no, do you know what? Actually, he's talking a lot of fucking sense. And even some of their new stuff is actually pretty decent as well. Some of their, what's that song, Waiting, I think it's called. It's very, very catchy. They're still doing their thing and they're still very successful at it. So, I mean, more power to them. Who'd have thought two Irish lads with plastic bags on their heads would get far?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's it exactly. So, fair play to them. Fair play to them. And they're still, they're still relevant, which, like, as we'll see as the decade goes on, like, these kind of viral sensations, and I know they were still on TV because we're still in that era, but, like, they were essentially a viral sensation.
That's how Tubby introduced him, sure. Yeah.
It's a smaller and smaller window of fame and very hard to keep going.
Yeah.
When you're kind of a bit of a novelty act. So these guys obviously have, as you say, they have, the different interests and different stuff that keeps them relevant. So,
sorry. And this is the year we also get the ruling that pubs can now serve alcohol on Good Friday, as we see the rugby match being shown on telly in a bar in Limerick and people enjoying some lovely Good Friday pints. One LBD gives out absolute stink about it. She's not happy at all.
No, people weren't. I went to that match in Limerick and I remember that. It was such an antiquated rule, really. And, like, the thing about Good Friday is, like, what do you do on Good Friday, Kieran? Do you know what you do on Good Friday? Do you have a thing you do on Good Friday?
I eat meat while my wife gives out to me about the fact that I shouldn't be eating meat. That's about it.
But that's it, Like, I mean, it's a day off for some people.
Yeah.
But yet they had the pubs closed. So it's like,
what's the point?
People do, and and then they scheduled the rugby match because it's an international competition. It was the URC, so it was like the Celtic League at the time, so it involved Welsh and Scottish and Italian teams. So, like, in those countries, Good Friday is just a regular day. So, like, you can have a match on a Friday evening like you would any other Friday. But here it was like, well, the people who were going to the match can't drink.
Yeah.
Everyone else was like, what? So it is, like, it's one of those things. But one thing I found out recently, right? I remember about a month ago, myself and some mates went on a trip to Frankfurt, a boozy weekend in Frankfurt for the weekend. Actually, Easter weekend. And I booked it. And when I was doing my research then into, like, places to go on the Friday night, I discovered that there are parts of Germany where the pubs don't open on Good Friday. And I thought I had unwittingly booked us into a country where they weren't going to open pubs for our boozy weekend.
I thought Germany not in where Frankfurt secular, is. Yeah.
I thought it was just Ireland and that we'd move, we've obviously moved past that now, but, like, I thought we were the only, like, backwards. So I thought it was, but apparently there are other countries, and I looked it up and there are other countries in Europe that still don't, parts of countries, as I said, that don't open their pubs on Good Friday.
Well, now, look, good to know we're not alone.
Yeah.
Up next, Obama says what we're all thinking. Why the taxpayer? As he says, never again should the taxpayer have to foot the bill for the financial failings of big corporations. We also see the beginnings of the investigations into basically what happened as regards the worldwide crash, as the CEO of Goldman Sachs is taken to task over supposed selling of crap and then betting against it, which I like that euphemism because it actually made it understandable for people like me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very true. And I always harp on about it when we're looking at these investigations and these clips and what was happening. Watch the movie The Big Short. It's the best way of understanding how the crash happened in America is watching that movie. It explains it really well. And essentially because it uses language like that people can understand.
Yeah.
And that film goes as far as explaining to you that people who make these, who work in these high-end finance jobs, like, they want you to think that what they do is like really difficult and that only they could do it. And that's why they use all the jargon, which is very true, by the way. But actually, it's not actually that difficult. So when the senator says, you know, you build up this crap and then you know, bet against it, sell the crap and then bet against it, he's essentially right. That's essentially what they did.
Okay, I must actually take you up on that recommendation one day and actually watch that film, because I feel like there is still a lot I might need to learn about this. And in Greece, we see massive protests as the government announces a huge spending deficit. In response, the EU and the IMF agree to a huge $110 billion package to bail out the country and prevent the failing of the euro. While back home, reports reveal that we're actually in bigger shape than we thought, as we see shots of ghost estates, a sight all too familiar across the landscape of Ireland for many years. As one Cork man says, you'd never in a million years dreamt of this happening. So yeah, Greece has always been a bit of a fire when it comes to finance and economics. It always seems like it's just always there in the news. They're always kind of struggling. I don't see this. You might be able to explain it better, but I don't really, like, in layman's terms, how do we get from Greece, you know, a spending deficit, Greece getting a $110 billion package, and then, you know, why would the euro fail if Greece were screwed, kind of?
So, I mean, it's obviously, like, that is quite complex, but the easy way to explain it is really that the euro zone, like, it's a community. So there are countries that have really big economies and yeah, stable economies, like Germany, for example, that anchor it. But then you have all these other countries, including our own at this time, that we're looking at, that, like, essentially, if the economy failed in Greece or in Ireland, and at one stage they thought it would be Ireland before it was going to be Greece, that it's to do with people's faith worldwide in the euro would be gone, and therefore the euro would be worthless, essentially, right, would be the worry, right? And that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, but that's kind of really what we're looking at. So because if a country in the eurozone fails, you're linked to all these other countries. So you're linked to Germany. So even though Germany's still relatively okay, like every other country is struggling, but it's not being as badly affected because they're a bit more prudent during the good times. You know, the fact that they're linked to you means you can bring down the currency that they've tied themselves to. And this was the argument against going into the euro. That's why the UK never went to the euro. They didn't want to be tied in with all these other countries and saying, well, we're going to have our house in order, but now we have to worry about Greece's house and, as it turned out, Ireland's house and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the structures, there wasn't a great economic structure in Greece. And while they have survived, their economy certainly isn't anywhere near as strong as Ireland's is now. You know, they haven't bounced back as much as we would have.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, feel it because the inflation is still here. But yeah, that's why. So basically, because it's a community of countries that share a currency.
And you know, in terms of the ghost estates issue, there, that's a for me where I live. That's kind of a hard pill to swallow, in a sense that, like, for a long, long time around here, there was a lot of ghost estates, because we had, like, down the road from where I'm, you know, I say where I'm from, I didn't move too far afield, but where from where my father's house is, would say, just up the road, like, there's still to this day, right, this huge wooden partition that you would see when you're building something. And it was like, God, I can't remember the name. It was something Celtic Tiger named, like, you know, Meadowfields or something like that. That was going to be the name of the estate. It was going to be this big modern estate built next to the GA pitch. And, you know, it has a picture on the front of what it's supposed to look like. And now there's nothing. It's used as a, you know, a stop for people who are heading from one pub to the other to take a piss. And that's it. And I know that, like, there was, I remember your man Shane Phelan, he had bought an estate with, you know, planning, developing it and selling the houses, etc. And that fell through. And I think, if I'm right in saying, a child was playing with his friends on one of these ghost estates and actually drowned. Yeah, there was one incident like that. But also, my brother-in-law, he lives in essentially a ghost estate. His they got their house and they live there now, and around the area, like the actual sort of, not the whole estate, but, like, I suppose what would you call the row of houses or the kind of cul-de-sac there. It's maybe 20 houses, and it's literally just him and his family. And I was joking with him one day. I said, oh, this must be great. You're like, you know, there's no one ever around or whatever. And he's like, it's fucking terrifying. He said, at night, because, like, you'd be in bed, you hear a bang outside, you know, where you live, he said, you know, you think, oh, it's just one of the neighbors getting into their heart. You hear a bang outside, you're out with your kitchen knife. Because you never know when somebody's going to be coming to take the copper wire at your house, you know. So it also has those kind of connotations to it as well. But you're like, it's just such a sad sight to see all these places that could have been something, you know, could have been, you know, somebody, like, I mean, you think about it, that's now what, this is 12 years ago. You could have had somebody that could have been somebody's house, you know, like, as in, a kid could have been reared there and is now going into secondary school. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Now it's gone. It's nothing. It's just sights. I'm sure some of them probably picked up. Well, they probably couldn't, I suppose, pick up where they left off. But, you know, there are more estates and things being built around here now. So it seems to be kind of leveling out. But just a shame to see even all that building material go to waste.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's it. And it was, it's just like, it's sad. On loads of levels. I mean, you hear that the guy, and I had a little laugh at his name when we were doing the live tweeting, Alan, but you know, he's one of many who were sold a dream.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't, he was, you know, the ordinary house buyer at the time was sold a dream. They weren't to know that the money could run out and that the builders might stop and might not be able to finish the houses and build the houses. And you've committed to a dream and you've lost, I mean, you probably lost your deposit, definitely. You know, whatever about anything else. But, like, it's just, I mean, like you said, like, people are sold a dream, and you're sold it and say, we're going to build this estate, and in 10 years time it's going to look like this, and you'll be in on the, you know, you'll be 10 years in there, and there'll be all this infrastructure and all this stuff, and you're, you know, only 30 minutes from whatever town, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And and then in the end, you know what looks like your dream house, and you don't get it. I mean, that's sad for everyone. So is, and they're an awful blight, and they still exist, ghost estates, but obviously some of them have been finished now or leveled and started again.
Because on the opposite side of things, in the States, there's this thing, you know, it's obviously completely made up. I don't believe anybody's born with this, but it's called suburban sprawlophobia, where you basically, you know, when you've got, like, somewhere, like, would you say, for argument's sake, Arizona or California, and you've got these places that, like, somebody bought, like, you know, a big huge plot of land and said, I'm going to develop houses on these, and the phobia is of being in, like, a modern area. You know, you've got your modern street with your modern cars, your modern house, and it's all nice, but you are, like, miles from anywhere. You are in the freaking desert. Yeah. You know what I mean? So when I think of, like, ghost estates, I often think of the opposite effect in the States, where it's like, here's, like, thousands of acres of land of all these fancy homes. They all look the same, but you're miles from everywhere. Because I don't know about you, and I don't know if this is something that happens with developers or whether it's just the way things are built. But I remember, like, growing up and, like, going to visit, like, my cousins would say, who live in the same estate, you know, kind of that I do now. And when I first moved into this house, I remember immediately thinking, this is exactly like my cousin's house, but backwards. As in, like, you know, you walk in the door of their house, the stairs is on the right, the bathroom's on the left. You walk into my house, the stairs on the left, the bathroom's on the left. You know, it's gas. So, you know, a lot of these places were destined to kind of to do just that. They were carbon copies of one house was a carbon copy of the other, just maybe reversed, you know. So it's not for, you know, originality sake that they ran out of ideas. It's just that they ran out of freaking money, which you know, it is certainly sad to see. And another sad thing is the unemployment, which reaches a 15-year high. As we see the all too familiar sight of feet shuffling along the dole queue. Joan Burton lays it all out for us as to how much money is being doled out to banks, but nobody really paid attention because Joan Burton's lips were moving. We also get a look at the doors of the dreaded NAMA, a state agency appointed to take on property loans of failed banks. It becomes very clear that billions of euro will never be recovered. As a result, the taxpayer takes the hit. Minister for Finance Brian Lenihan has a busy task ahead while also dealing with his personal fight against cancer. And Biffo gives us a speech on the state of the economy. So quite a bit to unpack there. I'm like as anybody who's listening to this podcast would know, I am not financially minded in the sense that, like, I don't know like the things that you know, which is fine. I'm perfectly fine living in ignorance in terms of economics. But I do know that every time somebody says NAMA, I go, because it was just everywhere back in the day. It was like NAMA, 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 Batman. But it was just everywhere. And like to look at their offices, it even seemed very, you know, as in we're all screwed now. And Joan Burton was kind of right, to be fair, in saying that, you know, oh, we're giving this much to bail out this bank, and this much to bail out this bank. And this whole segment just really goes to show that we're actually kind of, you could almost see how somebody might even get a bit of PTSD from watching this. Like, when you look back on it, like, it's like, oh, God, this was shitty.
Absolutely. And when you look at the... and the interesting thing we have, Kieran, about these episodes, but we don't have in any of the other really in years episodes we've done, is we have the Twitter reaction from last year when they were on, because they were, you know, we were obviously live tweeting, so were other people, and people were commenting, particularly after this first episode. And that was actually one of the common themes that people were talking about, was that those triggers, like things like NAMA and things like, especially for our generation where you were still young, like you were, you know, in your teens, early 20s, some even still in school. So you didn't probably understand at the time the gravity of what was happening, because you were still, you know, maybe living at home or starting to work or whatever it was, but you weren't really grasping it because you didn't have money. So therefore you couldn't have lost it, you know, like people who are maybe 10 years older than us. And they were the people that were stuck in the negative equity and you know, stuck with the ghost estates and the half-built houses, what have you. But yeah, it is, there are those triggers. And like things like NAMA were in the news, like you say, every day. And it is a name that I think until you die, when you hear the word NAMA, you will have that little shudder.
Yeah.
Well, I explained last week, you know, all of what NAMA is, but like you didn't know that. So all you knew was that NAMA bad, you know.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, that is not a good thing. And it was, you know, it wasn't a good thing in that, like, it had to be created to, you know, to try and keep the Irish banking system afloat, which is, you know, which is not good. So it was, you know, but you will, you'll get these triggers. And that's what's interesting about these episodes, because we've talked all the way along. Obviously, the first 30 odd episodes for both of us, we weren't alive, give or take, you know. And then obviously when you're a kid, you know, those stories, you have vague recollections of them. And as we obviously progress, we're now into the era of stuff that we were not only alive for, but watching the news or watching TV or understanding a bit of what was going on.
Yeah,
you're going to get those triggers and that stuff and go, oh God, I remember that was awful. And that's what's so great about this series for us, you know, and our generation of people, is that, like, you really lived this. Even the last decade we did, you were a teenager at the start of it. You weren't even a teenager. You know, you lived it, but you didn't really live it because you're in school and you're kind of isolated. This is like, you're out in the world now, and people of our age and people who are kind of hitting 30 or early 30s now, like, you were out in the world, whether you were in college or starting to work or whatever it was at this point. Over the next couple of episodes, you're going to get all these triggers of stuff and be like, oh God, I remember this happening. And it's both good and bad, like man slipping on ice. It's both good and bad.
Yeah. Because, like, we, funny enough, had a conversation only a couple of weeks ago, myself and my wife. We were driving through, our estate, whatever, and we got on conversation of the fact that the WIT is now turning into a university in the next couple of years. And we were talking about college fees and blah, blah, blah. And I was like trying to explain to her that there's a huge systemic issue in Waterford, in a sense that, like, you know, like to kind of bring it back to its basics, like, you know, would you say, for example, your parents might not be from the best background or whatever. They have you. They may not have jobs. Maybe one has job. Maybe one is sick, whatever. So then when it comes time for you to go to college, you know, around this time, around the time we went or whatever, student fees they won't have the money. So now because of that, you now have to go get a job, etc. You may not go to college. So, you know, you may not have the best opportunities afforded to you, etc., etc. So I was explaining that to her. And what I told her about was that around the time that we were in school. So I did my Leaving Cert in 2009. And around the time, like, I want to say maybe late 2008, 2009, there was a group of guys in my class. And one of the dads of that group, he owned a huge building company, like one of the biggest in town.
Yeah.
And his best mates that he'd been, the son who was in my class, his best mates in the class had all been friends since their primary school. And they had all planned, like, for years, like I'm talking throughout primary school, throughout secondary school, that when we left school, that you don't need to go to college, lads. Like, my dad will give you a job. You'll have a trade. You'll be a builder. You'll never have to go to college, blah, blah, blah. And then we met with our, like, guidance counselor in, like, a group session in class one day, like, around late 2008, 2009. And he was like, so, lads, you know, what are the plans? Are you going to college? What are you planning on doing or whatever? And, you know, he got to that group and they were like, nah, sure, like, we're getting a job on the building side or whatever. And I remember the guidance counselor being like, no, you're not. Do not, you will not, etc. And they were like, what are you talking about? And then he, like, basically gave him this very rundown. He was like, lads, NAM are going to come in, you know, we're going to be billions in debt, the banks are going to this, all. He gave him all this horror story, but it actually stuck with him. And I just remember the last months running up to the Leaving Cert, there was this mad panic of these lads who'd never studied a day in their life to get the best possible results, to make chicken salad out of chicken shit, to just get something so that they could at least do a PLC course and try something else, because they just had this in their head. They were going to be builders, and fair play, they should have, because at the time we were growing up, it was all looking rosy, and then this comes along. And that's why, like, for a lot of people, like we said, NAMA is like a trigger word. You know, NAMA and austerity and just things like that. It's just, it gives you that little guah and just makes you feel dirty.
Yeah, sure does.
Up next, tragic news, as we're told by Anne Doyle that Jerry Ryan has passed away. He was just 53 years of age. Dave Fanning says that he's just lost the funniest person he's ever known in his life. As we're told, the cause of his death would later be revealed to be heart failure with cocaine as a possible trigger. This was one of the very first, like, oh my God, celebrity deaths, because I can't remember off the top of my head. I think this may have been maybe just after Katie French or before. Remember Katie French? She was the model. She was friends with.
Yeah, Danny. I think she might have been before. But not like,
too
yeah,
far
maybe
before, yeah.
Yeah, maybe not very far. Not very. Her funeral actually was in a scary run from. I think she was like 2007 or 8 maybe.
Yeah, and this kind of, when it happened with Jerry Ryan, then it kind of triggered the whole conversation about, right, how many people are actually doing cocaine and, you know, what can we, you know, I suppose what can be done. But I mean, the big thing was, like, Jerry Ryan back in the day was a bit of an advocate for don't do drugs, because you remember he did that song, that rap song. You remember it was like, you know, dope, you got no hope. Something like that. I don't know. But it was a huge shock because, like I said, he was only 53. He was very young, you know, to die of heart failure. So it was sad. And he was an icon for a lot of people, I think.
He was. And, you know, RT did a documentary about him last year. I guess you got to remember radio DJs of that time, like the 80s and 90s, and obviously any time before kind of the advent of podcasts like our own, you know, they were the voice for people. Like, you know, you didn't have a huge choice, so, like, you know, Jerry Ryan was on 2FM, and he was a bit of a shock jock. He was loud and he was abrasive, and he was definitely a larger than life personality, but he was on the right side. As Dave Fanning said, he's the funniest person he ever met. He was on the right side. He had the charm and the funniness to not be like boorish with his, you know, because he's a big guy who was like loud and liked his cigars and his, obviously, his coke and whatever else, his whiskey, whatever it was, and I'm very much a Celtic Tiger socialite as well, you know, but like universally loved in Ireland. And I think his death definitely shocked people. And I think, like you mentioned Katie French as well, there was definitely at this time or this period, you know, the after effects of the fact that cocaine became the drug of choice during the Celtic Tiger was being seen, because people were still doing it, but it had changed, because, like, everything, drug the drug trade isn't recession proof either. So like, you know, it was being cut differently and stuff like that. Now in Katie French's case, that's apparently what did for her was what it was a batch of bad cocaine. I know with Jerry Ryan, it was more of a trigger. You know, he'd obviously probably wasn't living the healthiest lifestyle, and you know, his heart, I think, you know, went. But I think it says it here actually that they thought cocaine was a trigger. It just you know, the fact that it was such a part of the Celtic Tiger life, and obviously people, just because the crash happens and the Celtic Tiger goes, people don't go, I won't do any more coke. You know, it is addictive, and
yeah,
I guess you know, unfortunately, people kept doing it. Did take lives.
No, you're dead right. And like Dave Fanning in particular, to see him kind of very somber, like, I mean, you're right, what you said about those generation of radio DJs, because I mean, the big one for me wasn't so much Jerry Ryan, but was Tony Fenton, you know, when he passed away, especially. There's very little of those kind of legendary DJs left. Now, local radio is just filled with guys in their 40s and early 50s who still gel their hair and think that they're in with the in crowd. And it just you know, they don't make them like they used to. This we also see CCTV footage of the earthquake in Haiti, which would kill nearly 222,000 people, with over 2 million displaced. We see horrific scenes of people in tents trying to keep the rain of a monsoon out of their encampment. Around the time this happened, this was like, you know, I was 18, and you know, big grown man can make my own decisions. I wanted to go to Haiti and help the people over there build houses, because I remember George Hook did a campaign on his radio show, and I think on telly as well, where he said, you know, we want people to go over, we want people to help, and blah, blah, blah. And I remember going on a website that he was, you know, advertising on, whatever, for people to sign up. And I was like, yeah, deadly right, going to sign up, going to do this. And then it was like, you needed to raise like $3,000. And then I was like, fucking hell, I'm 18, I'm not in college, I'm not in school. Like, where the hell am I going to get $3,000 out of? So I kind of gave up on that. But it was shocking, like, the amount of people that 222,000 people has to be up there with, like, the highest number of people killed in an earthquake. That's incredible numbers.
Oh, yeah, massive. And, like, it just, it's probably just to do with the conditions of the country, but, like, it's just, yeah, it's scary. And the scenes here with the rain and the mud and all that, it just starts, it's horrific, you know, it really is.
Yeah, that's like a breeding ground for disease, and it's just, it's not a pretty picture. This is also the year of the Chilean miners disaster, as 33 miners are trapped 700 meters below the ground in a mine. Miraculously, after 17 days, rescuers make contact and confirm the miners are alive. And after a total of 69 days underground, the miners are rescued one by one. 60, like, that's what, over 2 months underground. And only, oh, I couldn't, I, that's probably my worst fucking fear right there, being stuck. Like, I mean, I know there was 33 of them, I'm sure they kept themselves going, kept themselves busy, but that's got to be some scary fucking shit, like, to not have anybody communicate with you for 17 days while you're stuck underground, and then be stuck there for a total of 69 days.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is just, yeah, scary stuff. Scary stuff. I think you can't comprehend something like that. But it was such, I just remember this being such big news at the time, and it was really like followed. And then it was an amazing rescue, you know, amazing. I remember when they finally managed to make contact with them and realized they were alive, and then managed to devise a way of getting food and supplies and light into them and stuff, was just amazing. And then I think the stories of that the men told when they got out, of how they kept their spirits up and, you know, kept everyone going. And that's like
inspiration.
Yeah.
It's like it's like that kid, that soccer team in, was it China? I think they went into the cave and they got flooded in. I remember that whole rescue. And then of course the horror story of that guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it's a very famous case of a guy who went exploring caves, fell into a groove upside down. And they it was hours before anybody found him, and when they found him, they pulled him out halfway, and then he slipped and got stuck even further, and he's catacombed there now, basically. They couldn't get his body out. In Ireland, a cargo ship is loaded with humanitarian aid bound for an international flotilla, which is set to sail to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. As the first of the flotilla arrive, Israeli forces seize control aggressively, which would end with 9 Turkish activists being killed. An Israeli spokesman explains that they made repeated attempts to ask, "Can we have your ship nicely, please, so we can bring the stuff to the people we're fighting?" Smell of bullshit right there. The 19 people aboard the Irish ship, the Rachel Corrie, are arrested and deported from Israel. Don't mean to point fingers, but I just think, you know, they knew what they were doing, I think, because they boarded the Turkish ship and killed 9 people. They boarded the Irish ship and they just told them, go home. You know, there's definite, tic-tac in there, in a sense that be careful who you're aiming at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you absolutely. Know? I think the people on the ship, as undoubtedly scary, I'm sure, as it was, like, they were probably expecting it, and they probably knew they were relatively safe, in as much as, they maybe weren't going to be killed, you know, but I'm sure they were still roughed up a bit, or, well, it says without any resistance, I know, but I think that's probably the difference maybe as well, I guess they kind of probably knew going in that they were going to meet Israeli forces at some point.
Oh yeah, totally. But in fairness, a very noble thing for them to do, to go and help, because we've always had a close relationship with Palestinians, the Irish people have.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to help them, because look at the boycott of Dunn Stores, for Christ's sake. Dunn Stores workers refusing to handle Israeli products is what I meant to say. Fair play. It's certainly, I love the whole thing of look, you're not coming in, right? But you just give me the food and we'll make sure that it gets to whoever it needs to get to. It's like, I think I'll trust this guy. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, absolutely. And just before, actually, a little throwback here. So one of the people named as one of the passengers and one of the leaders of the Free Gaza movement is Mairead Corrigan Maguire. I don't know if you recognize her, Kieran, from our mid-70s episodes, but Mairead Corrigan, as she was known in our 1975 and 76 episodes, was the woman who won a Nobel Peace Prize for founding the Women for Peace. She was the woman whose
sister
and niece's sister was killed in a bombing, or in a car. Was it a getaway car hit her? Three children were killed, and she founded the Women for Peace movement with Betty Williams and they won the Nobel Peace Prize. So that is Mairead Corrigan Maguire from all those years ago. Here she is, still fighting fights and trying to do good, which is fantastic.
Fair play to her. She's going in the Reeling in Your Ears Hall of Fame.
Yes, absolutely.
So we are halfway through the show. So it's time for Simon Says. You know the rules, 30 seconds, 3 questions. As John Anderson, the referee from Gladiator, said, are you ready?
Never on, but let's go anyway.
Alrighty, so I'm going to start off a bit hard this year. Giggity. So, who won the Royal Rumble this year?
Edge.
Oh, yes, bang on. In the championship opener for Leeds, they played Doncaster Rovers. What was the score?
Did they? Fuck. 2-1.
Oh, bingo. Which popular Desert Island show ended this year?
Desert Island? Survivor?
No, oh, still going. Lost.
Sorry, I got it. Brain fired on that one. Lost, yes, of course. I think I said before, I never watched Lost.
Yeah, I watched
it. It was all my friends would talk about back before, you know, subscription TV. So it was on the Monday. So in school, we used to talk about it, and I used to never watch it.
I'm telling you, Monday night television on RT2 was the bomb. There was Lost, Prison Break at the Panel, and the Podge and Rod show. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I only watched the Panel and Podge and Rod. I didn't watch it.
Come on.
I was at training or something on a Monday. I feel like I just got in and watched the Panel and Podge and Rod.
No, fair play to you. Yeah, I don't know how you got Edge so quickly. That's because it took, because I had to think about that one. I had to Google that one. Couldn't remember.
Yeah, I don't know, because I still had half an interest in wrestling at the time, but I wouldn't say I watched it all the time. But I
was the same.
Come I on, have this thing about trivia and like the years, like same with FA Cups. Like I can probably tell you, if you name random years, I can probably tell you who won it, certainly, if not what the score was in the final. But and I think I'm similar with kind of Royal Rumbles and stuff. Now, I wouldn't be, I definitely wouldn't know every year, particularly into this decade. But But yeah, so
I'd have to. I'd be the
just,
same. Yeah,
I just have Edge associated with that year for some reason. Was that a comeback from an injury or
yes,
something like that?
You're bang on. You're
there
bang
was a couple
on.
Of years like Cena won it one of the years, and I know Triple H did it previously when coming back from injuries. It was kind of a thing.
No, you're bang on for the background story for those interested. So yeah, basically, the whole story was that Edge was at one point in 2009. He was tag team partners with Chris Jericho. They held to the tag team titles. Edge got a neck injury. He went out. Chris Jericho moved on and teamed with the Big Show instead, carrying the titles over for a couple of months. Edge was out. Edge was, I think, number 28 or 20, 30, one of them in the Royal Rumble. He eliminated Chris Jericho to a huge pop and then eliminated John Cena, cementing himself. Now, funny enough, he would actually retire a year later. He's still wrestling to this day, but he retired.
yeah, he did, yeah.
At that point. Yeah, and the can you remember whether Leeds won or lost against Doncaster?
I'm going to say they won.
No, they lost.
Did they?
They did. They lost 2-1 to Doncaster Rovers.
Did they? I have no memory of that.
That's in my the website that I use to look up these soccer things. I'm running out of Leeds questions.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember that game, but it was a while ago. So
that's true.
I believe you.
Yeah, and lost. I'm like you. I didn't actually like. I kind of lost interest. Funny enough, lost interest after like season 3, and then. I just watched it like recently enough. I got as far as season 2 and again I lost interest, so that doesn't say much for the show if you lose interest twice in a row after the same series. Just fuck it, screw it, I'm done with it. So that brings us to one of my favourite segments, Simon's favourite Twitter page. So what have you've had 2 weeks, what have you found for us?
Yes, Kieran, so we're going to go a little bit different, right? So you were very topical in your intro and I've also been very topical with my Twitter page of the week. So the Twitter page of the week for this week is a gentleman by the name of Jim Watterson. That's at Jim Watterson. So that's J-I-M W-A-T-E-R-S-O-N. So at Jim Watterson. Now, Jim Watterson is a journalist. This is not a satire. This is true life. He's a media editor, actually, at The Guardian in the UK. And he was on the radio at the start of the week when I was dropping my daughter up to creche. And he was brought on to speak about one specific thing, which was the biggest news story of the week. Of course, the Agatha Christie trial.
Oh, yes.
And Jim is live tweeting from the courtroom. I said this isn't satire, but if you just read these tweets and didn't know the context that there's a real trial going on, you would 100% believe that this is piss take. I don't know if you've seen any of these, if you've seen anything coming out of this trial.
Oh, I have. Yeah. Where
the Colleen Rooney Rebecca Vardy trial. Which has captured imaginations everywhere. Now, I will preface it by saying that at the start of the week, I was adamant that I would not get involved, I would not lower myself to this celebrity gossip, which I try and avoid at all costs, you know, celebrity type things. I don't like it. You know, Kardashians, all that kind of stuff. But I've been sucked in. Sucked in, right? By the absolute outlandishness of what is going on in this case, of what is essentially two rich women having a little war. You know, and it's just gotten so far that that it's gone to court. So the reason I picked Jim, right, because a few people live tweeting, but Jim is a fantastic. I feel like his pithy tone is coming through at all times. Like he's treating this with the disdain that it deserves, a lot of it, but kind of passing it off with a bit of gravitas. So for example, I'll just bring you a tweet from day one here. David Sherborne, Rooney's barrister, discusses claims that Vardy tried to move seats at a 2018 World Cup match to be more prominent in paparazzi photos. The High Court hears the lawyer enunciate a phrase supposedly uttered in the stadium, quotation marks, "We can sit where we like, fuck off." the image of this assumedly very posh barrister you know, saying that phrase, even as a quote in court, is just has just tickled me. I'll give you another one. he's just given us here on Monday, Tuesday, which was the first day of the trial. He's just given us a little bit of dialogue. So David Sherborne acting for Rooney. What does FFS stand for? Vardy. This is during Rebecca Vardy's cross or examination. Vardy, can I? Judge, yes. Vardy, for fuck's sake. Sherborne confirms he just wanted to check that he understood. And then Jim Watterson signs off the tweet by saying, this is day one of a 7-day trial. So this is what I mean about him kind of, he's treating it with the, you know, the ridiculousness that it deserves while reporting very accurately on it, which is a hard thing to do. There was one that I saw the other day that I really just wanted to quote here. There was also during Rebecca Vardy's cross examination on Wednesday, a debate about whether people were fuming or not. So Vardy is being cross-examined about texts to her agent about Riyad Mahrez. Vardy, Mahrez not turned up to training again. The lads are fuming. Agent, really? Why don't you tell Rob Dorsett, who's a Sky Sports reporter for those people who watch Sky Sports News. Vardy, I just don't want it coming back on me. Vardy has asked if the info came from the Leicester City dressing room, which included her husband, Jamie. Did you or did you not know that the lads were fuming? She said it was gossip. I had heard and overheard. Jamie and I never discussed whether the lads were fuming. So that paints a brilliant picture about, what was probably quite a lengthy discussion about whether the lads were indeed fuming or not. So again, this is just the ridiculousness of this trial writ large. And Jim Watterson is doing a service to the world.
Oh, yeah.
By putting it out there. This is, of course, only made good by the details of this case, which include Rebecca Vardy's phone going missing in the North Sea. I don't know if you're.
Oh yeah, this. I heard this. This is my favorite.
She was asked to, you know, hand over her WhatsApp messages, and suddenly, some idiot in Rebecca Vardy's publicity team lost her phone off the side of a boat, totally accidentally, of course. So unfortunately, no one can access the messages because there's also an issue with the backup, which apparently has gone into a black hole of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
There was one from Wednesday which I had to actually look up. So I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase ophiophobe,
no.
Kieran. An ophiophobe is someone who has an extreme overwhelming fear of snakes.
Okay. That'll be my wife.
Tweeted, any ophiophobes in court are warned to look away. As Rooney's lawyer, David Sherborne, turns to a picture of Vardy hugging a, quotations, huge snake. There's a lot of discussion of how paparazzi work today, i.e. celebrities often actively collaborate with a photographer, then split the fee. So there again, this is just, you know, these are just like random little That's things that are hilarious. Happening. Jim Watterson has it all linked in one massive thread here. The quotations need no embellishment. Like, this is comedy gold in real life. And I would recommend anyone to follow Jim Watterson at Jim Watterson for any of these tweets. So something a little bit different. It's not going to last that long. I think the trial is due to end early next week, but definitely worth a read.
That's brilliant. I did see the tweet in relation to the phone falling in the ocean, and the solicitor was like, you know, so it's in the bottom of Davy Jones's locker then. And Rebecca Vardy went, who's Davy Jones? Which, just caps it off.
And there was a good one. There was a good one today. Obviously, Wayne Rooney is in court supporting Colleen as a good husband who has a bit of free time because Derby County season is over. He's the man of Derby County. Unfortunately, Jamie Vardy is still playing for Leicester, so he can't attend. But there was a tweet from today just before I sign off this bit. Colleen Rooney is giving evidence and says she believes Vardy was the leaker. Hugh Tomlinson, QC for Vardy, says beliefs do not count as evidence. You might believe Derby County might win the Premiership in 2 years' time. It's not evidence, is it? Wayne does not react. just, this is what I'm talking about with this guy. He just has a beautiful... a beautiful way of laying out these tweets.
That's
Jim
fucking
Waterson at Jim
gorgeous.
Waterson, something a bit different for today. Can't get sat, you know, who needs satire or parody accounts when you got the real deal right here?
Absolutely. Who needs the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial when you've got Agatha Christie? That's brilliant for this week's Twitter page of the week. That's my new favorite so far. I'm definitely going to keep up with that guy. Up next, turtleneck aficionado Steve Jobs takes the stage as he unveils the iPad, Apple's own iOS tablet. To be fair, like I often kind of scoff laugh when they do these big, well, they used to do these big announcements. Now, I mean, think about it. Like the tablet is a great invention, especially when it comes to things like, you know, they've got them in McDonald's to keep the children occupied. They've got them in schools to help kids with learning difficulties. It's, to be honest, like whatever about a mobile phone, any twat can have a mobile phone. But like these tablets are just, they're great, to be fair.
They are, yeah, they are. And like, obviously it was pretty revolutionary at the time. Like you could have everything pretty much, obviously it isn't everything, but like a lot of what your computer could do. And, you know, laptops are still pretty big and chunky at the time. And you can have it on this pretty thin tablet, you know, and it'll obviously it's 12 years ago, it will look a bit dated now, but it was revolutionary at the time.
Absolutely,
you know, really was groundbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's still like, I mean, good lord, I've when I give my child her tablet, I get silence, so happy days. And Google Street View was launched this year, which to this day still provides me with hours of entertainment when I'm on the late shift.
Yeah,
it is a great, like, to be fair, it's pretty good in the sense that like anytime we book a hotel for somewhere that we're going abroad or whatever, I just pop it into Google Street View so I make sure that I'm not staying in like the hood.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly great for that. And just getting a sense. I know it is kind of judging a book by a cover, but at the same time, it's getting a sense of what the area is like, which you never could do before, you know. So it's definitely good from that point of view.
Absolutely. In keeping with tech, Dublin's Web Summit conference discussing the future of technology is also launched this year as it hopes to combine investors in tech with innovators. We hear from Twitter founder Jack Dorsey as he talks about how easy it is to use a mobile device. Simon Coveney, of course, no exception to talking shit. We also, speaking of talking shit, get an interview with Paddy Cosgrove, but anywho.
Less said about that, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, it's a great concept, you know, combining investors with innovators. It's what gave birth to that smug little prick on the AIB ad, but like, oh yeah, this is my $1 billion app idea. Shove it up your hole. It's nice to see the actual kind of turn of the century, like, right, Ireland getting in there. I don't remember whether it was like this one or whether it was maybe the next couple or whatever, but they did have one instance where they booked out, I want to say, a conference center of some description in Dublin, and there was problems with the Wi-Fi where after so many people logged onto it, it just crashed. Which is quite funny when you think about it. But speaking of Simon Coveney talking shit, what he's alluding to is essentially, this is what he's tweeted. He said, "God, what an uninspiring interview by Taoiseach this morning. He sounded halfway between drunk and hungover and totally disinterested." Which, to be fair, if somebody was to sound hungover, drunk and disinterested, it would sound exactly like this Brian Cowan interview. He would be taken to task, of course, by on his appearance of a morning talk show, where, to be fair, he did sound hungover to death. He dismisses the claims as nonsense, which is what a man who was hungover the day before says the day after he's hungover. I wasn't hungover. I'm fine.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. Yeah, it was it. When you hear the audio, which obviously you do hear a bit of the audio on this episode, he is slurring his words. He is getting stuff wrong.
Yeah.
He was, and of course, someone had filmed him, you know, and this is a new phenomenon for our new series of Really Good Years, singing late in the evening in the pub the night, or the bar the night before, and at the Fianna Fáil, after the Fianna Fáil event, whatever it was, or the think-in or whatever it was. Now, look, we've all been there. We've all gone to work. hungover slash still drunk.
yeah, we have.
I feel like, I mean, I can't do it as much anymore.
No,
but,
God, no.
I feel like when I was doing it a bit more, the idea really was to have as clear a morning as possible. So definitely don't go on national radio, you know,
yeah,
be interviewed. But, you know, yeah, what, like, it's funny, right? Because I think when I was doing the research for the episode, I obviously watched this again. The first thing I thought about when I read Simon Coveney's tweet there was, if someone in Sinn Féin now tweeted that about Simon Coveney,
ooh,
and it was the same situation, he would absolutely lambaste them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, so it's interesting to see Fine Gael here as the party who haven't been in power for a while, and playing that opposition role. And when they shit on Sinn Féin so much for doing the same thing now, you know, it's very interesting. But yeah, this was an unseemly thing. And I think Brian Cowan's reaction to it is that's what he's getting at. He's kind of saying, look, this is kind of below the belt stuff.
Yeah.
He didn't feel he was drunk. Nobody knows. Only he knows. As you say, he's not going to admit he was. So, you know, like, what, you know, what, whatever. Again, I've been there. I've been that soldier. Oh, yeah. I've been at work at 10 a.m. going, I'm not drunk. You probably were. Because then you try and remember the rest of the day and you go, I don't remember what I did this morning.
Oh, yeah.
I hope I didn't tell any clients, you know, X, Y, Z. Again, would I stress, if anyone from my current employer is listening, many years ago, not even in that company. So, you know, don't concern
yourself. Yeah. Yeah, I'd be the same. I'd also like to put that caveat out there, because, like, God, when I was young and working in a shop, like, I did not give a shit. I remember once I went into work, like, after being on, like, oh God, I'd say about an 8-9 hour bender, and like, didn't stop drinking until like 4 a.m. Woke up to open the shop at 7. I was standing at the counter, still tipsy, like, chatting shit to the customers coming in to buy the milk at 8. And my supervisor literally came over to me and was like, you're still drunk. And I went, no, I'm fine. They were like, no, you're still drunk because you're actually talking to people. I was like, yeah, all right, I might be still a little bit drunk. I was going to go have a coffee. Yeah. unfortunately, we're still dealing with the fallout of the clerical sex abuse scandal in 2010. Ireland's bishops are summoned to Rome, where they're informed that sex abuse is a heinous crime. Really? We have to get a flight just to be told that?
Yeah, I mean, surely that just goes without saying.
That could have been put in an email.
Yeah.
You know, one survivor states that admitting the bishops didn't do enough to intervene is miles away from admitting to an actual cover-up. A letter of apology is sent to all Irish Catholics. However, the full truth behind it is all still ignored, still unsolved, still swept under the rug. So, I mean, you kind of keep a data log of in your mind of all of the episodes that we've been through and what we discussed. I don't even remember how long ago it was that this was first brought up. But now, only 12 years ago, and even now, today, we're still dealing with the fallout of the goings-on of the institutions and the Catholics, the Catholic priests back in, and the practices, I suppose, back in the day.
Yeah, we are. We spoke about it at length last episode, you know, but yeah, look, it's like, suffice it to say, this is a theme,
yeah,
that is going to run over these episodes of reeling in the years that we're covering. And it definitely is... It definitely is awful that the people who suffered had to wait so long for any, yeah, kind of apology. And we saw, you know, Michael O'Brien talk last week about, yeah, mealy-mouthed apologies. And again, this is another one where, you know, the survivors, yeah, are saying, you are not going far enough. You're not admitting to cover-ups. You're,
yeah,
you're saying, oh, we're, you know, we're sorry people were abused. And of course you are, but, like, there has to be more than that.
No, absolutely. 100%. Like, I remember around 2005, 2006, I think there was a newsletter published in every church in Ireland. And it wasn't so much an apology, but kind of a letter from the Pope to the people of Ireland acknowledging this and whatever. And even at the age of, I want to say, like 13, 14, like, I knew that this was what we would call now kind of, you know, whitewashing. You know, where it's like just a letter that's thrown out there with no real meaning behind it. You know, and I suppose the Pope at the time, was it Ratzinger, Pope Benedict. He was known for kind of not having the best approach to these kind of things. As in, he wanted to go in, he wanted to be Pope, he wanted to say his prayers, he wanted to do his thing. And when it came to this, he kind of had no time for it. Whereas, support him or don't, Pope Francis seems a bit more involved. in the goings on. He's apologized numerous times. You know, he's advocated for sort of, you know, tell the people the truth kind of thing. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people still waiting on these truths, especially now, you know, with the whole mommy and baby homes, mother and baby homes, and things like that. It's still, it just seems as though, you know, it happens. We, you know, there's papers, reports written on it. It kind of goes away and then something else pops up. So we're dealing with it in 2010. We're dealing with it now. I think we're probably going to be, I think our children are going to still be dealing with the fallout of this.
Yeah, I think
In years to come, unfortunately. And in keeping with the dealings of our past, three bodies of paramilitaries are also discovered in what appears to be a bog, as we hear from the widow of Charlie Armstrong, who was abducted and killed and then buried in an unknown location in 1981. 29 years not knowing where your husband is buried is a long, long time. And in Derry, people marched to Gillall Square 38 years after the Bloody Sunday massacre, where they acknowledged that the victims of the massacre did no wrong, and David Cameron apologises on behalf of the government and country. We watched that episode, you know, with the Bloody Sunday, and it was a tough watch.
Yeah.
You know, it was a tough thing to revisit. It's a stain on our history in a sense that it's just awful, to be fair, and to see what these what these families would have been dragged through, you know, to only get justice essentially in 2010, 38 years later, to be told, yeah, all right, okay, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter, they did nothing wrong. You know, it's an official apology. Like, look, it's, to be fair, to call a spade, it's no good 38 years later. You know, it's something, but it's too little too late, I think.
Yeah, it is, and like, it's, you know, we still have to wait a few more years to kind of get the actual,
yeah,
you know, confirmation that of what the people that were there had long said, which was that the paratroopers fired, yeah, on them and all the rest of it. And yeah, look, I think it felt like one of those things where Cameron was new in the job and this was, yeah, one of the things that he could do, and not curry favor, but to you know, to show himself as a good guy and all the rest of it. And fair play, he did it. No other prime minister had done that before, so you know, there is something to that. But like the apologies for the sexual abuse that we just talked about, it's too little too late. It's 38 years of a battle for people. That is half a lifetime, you know. Yeah. For some people, for a lot of people, it's people's prime years. It's reminiscent of other things like Hillsborough, which is a similar thing in the UK, where
I was just about to say, yeah,
an injustice is done, there's a cover up, and it takes, you know, a couple of generations and you know, people fighting until they die and all the rest of it, just to get any kind of acknowledgement, even that they weren't in the wrong. And that's the thing, because it's a tarring with a brush. It's saying these guys attacked the army, and it's only after that the British army fired back and killed people. You know, that tars those people with a brush. Those people were there in a peaceful protest, were fired at and were killed, were murdered. And that's, you know, that was, they wanted the acknowledgement of that, and at least they got that eventually. But yeah, having it 38 years later is no good, really.
Absolutely. In the World Cup, over more lighthearted stuff, I had forgotten about vuvuzelas. Talk about your PTSD. Oh my God, what an awful sound. England are denied a clear goal after a Frank Lampard chicken dipper, and get shafted then by losing 4-1. Johnny Giles foreshadows VAR, says there need to be big changes after this. After a Fabregas goal, Spain end up winning 1-0 over Holland to take the trophy home. That's a double-sided coin, isn't it? On one hand, you're like, nah, football needs to be fair. I'm glad we kind of have something like VAR to have a look at this. But on the other hand, it's England. So,
yeah, and this is funny, because obviously we talked about Henri last week and needing video ref to sort that out. And yeah, this is the flip side, because it was one of those. England were by far the worst team in this game. Germany had a good World Cup, a real strong young side, and England were a bit of a mess at the time. But yet they were 2-1 down, having got back into the game at 2-0, they got back to 2-1. Then this would have made it 2-2, and you'd have felt maybe the momentum might have changed. And it when you watch it, like, it's so clearly over the line.
Oh, it's so
you don't even need video ref. I mean, like, it's so clearly over the line. But even for that, what they've brought in, obviously, now is that the referees, there's a sensor in the ball, and the referees watch buzzes whether to tell them if the ball has crossed the line or not. That's so easy. You didn't need a video ref. Actually, VAR doesn't adjudicate on balls over the line. Like, that's, it's literally this, it's like Hawkeye kind of sensor, you know, like with tennis and stuff like that. So it's very simple technology, really. But it wasn't available then, and it was karma for 66, the World Cup final where
and the guard,
you know, where, well, but even 66 is Jeff Hurst. Bounced down, and obviously at the time there wasn't much of a camera angle, but the Germans said it definitely didn't cross the line. Well, this one and the England got the benefit of that one, but they didn't get this one, and they got pummeled by a much better Germany side. But the shoe was on the other foot, because we'd all been absolutely raging about Henri like 6-7 months before this, and then it was like, no, we don't need VAR. That's fine. It was England.
Now you know how it feels. It's like very reminiscent of a couple of years before this. I don't know if you remember Roy Carroll and Pedro Mendes.
Yes, I do remember
that. Good gravy. Now there's a reason for VAR, or for, you know, the sensors or what have you, right there. Seriously, big balls in Croke Park next, as we see Kilkenny take on Tipperary on their way 4-4 in a row. What the fuck is with the giant inflatable splitters? Who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, very, very odd. A very strange concept, I guess.
My money's on Wavin. I bet you they were trying to crack.
Definitely, it's always Wavin. this was Kilkenny going for 5 in a row and Tip putting a stop to it. Larkor was unplayable on the day. Tip finally, or somebody finally beating Kilkenny after their half a decade of dominance. Which is great. Now, of course, Kilkenny won the next two again, and a couple more after. But this was a good day, I think, for the rest of the country. Yeah. But no one really likes Tip.
What did they reach in the end? After this interception, did they get higher than 5? Wasn't it?
No, they haven't done 5 in a row, but they so this was 4. They won the next two after this, and then they won another two after. So Clare won in 2013, then they won another two. So under Cody, they essentially won 9 in 11 years.
Plus a few before as well, because
remember Cork broke that up, but they won a few before that. So, like, I mean, Cody's there over 20 years now, and I think he has...
Oh, longer.
13 All-Irelands now, and they haven't won one since 2015. So it's getting on now. Limerick could match it.
I think what... just when you say, Brian Cody's been there, over, 20 years, like, I think you might have the same problem that I do, in a sense that, like, to me, when I think 20 years, right, I automatically think, the 1980s, maybe the 1990s. 20 years ago was 2002.
Yes. Yeah. So sorry. He has been there since, I think, 99 or 98. So whatever that is.
I think even longer before that. Hang on. I'm going to have a quick look, because I think he was there a bit before Kilkenny hurling manager, or when did he take the reins? Yeah, no, you're right, actually. Sorry, 98. Funny enough, that's the year I started going to the games with my dad. So maybe I'm the thing that's keeping Brian Cody alive. Who knows?
Maybe.
And in the football, it's North versus South, as we see Cork take on Down for the Sam Maguire. The Rebel County fight back from a losing first half to win 16-15 in the end. Am I making this up? I could be totally making this up, but did Cork not play their Gaelic and their hurling in a red jersey as opposed to a white?
They did, right? But what you're seeing here is the now commonplace change strip rules, which are unique to the GAA, where both teams wear their second jersey.
Right.
So you'll see this when Kerry play Mayo nowadays, right? And they both wear green, obviously, Kerry green and gold.
Yeah, I can understand that. Red. Yeah.
So they both, in soccer or in rugby, like, one team will change their jersey. So in soccer, it's
okay.
Rugby, it's usually actually more the home team that does.
Right.
In Gaelic sport in the last 10 years, what's actually happened is that both teams, like when Wexford play Galway and hurling, both teams wear different colours. Galway wore their white strip in the last most recent meeting, and Wexford wore a navy strip. So both teams change, even though, like, I know obviously this is a neutral venue, but like that was a home game actually for Galway. But you know, it's just So what actually you're seeing here is Cork in their change strip of white, and Down in, I think, yellow.
Was it black and yellow? Herbs,
black and yellow, yeah. And both usually wear red, so that's what you're seeing here.
Uh-huh.
So yes, Cork would normally wear a red jersey, but they both changed for whatever reason. And this is interesting because neither side have done a tap in football since, and both are actually at a pretty low ebb. Like down the doldrums, really. Considering this isn't that long ago, when it was 12 years, but you know, they both
had a pretty
rapid decline. Yeah, this was a year where. Obviously Dublin were up and coming, but they shot themselves in the foot and they lost to Cork at some stage of this. And Kerry, Cork managed to get over Kerry finally. So the big teams kind of fell out before the final and left to relatively, I know Cork had been in a couple of All-Irelands previously, but in the last couple of years before this, but two relatively new sides, which was nice to see.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd like to know what happens if both teams say, yeah, we'll play both our away kids, but both our away kids are the same colour too.
Yeah, God, I know.
We also see the debut this year of the crime drama Love Hate. I never watched it. Any good?
Kin Before Kin. Yeah, it is. What you'll see, right? I'm a big fan of Love Hate. I watched it all when it was on, and I've rewatched it several times. Loved it. Thought it was one of the best things RTE ever did. And it is pure RTE made, so it's not one of these things where somebody in England had to make it and RG just showed it. You know, it's great writing, but when you watch the actual first series, which is only 4 episodes, that was released, which was initially going to be a standalone, it's not great. It got renewed and then took off. So actually the first series, it's fine, but it's much more like everyone's very pretty and there's much more love involved, because the idea was it was going to be like,
more
you
love,
know,
less hate.
What it became was a really gritty, like American style, you know, gangster series, and they kind of dial back the love part because that's not real. Like obviously people who are involved in drug cartels in Ireland have relationships, but it was very like good looking boy meet and good looking girl, you know, were together, and then one of the boy has to leave and now he's back and now she's with someone else, and it's like a little triangle. No, just show us everyone shooting each other. So it's definitely, the whole series is well worth the watch, Kieran. I think you'd really enjoy it. If you liked Kin, it's better than Kin. It is much better than Kin.
And there's nothing better than Kin, but I'll definitely give it a go. My wife has been on to me for ages to get into it, so I think it might be one of those things.
Well, even the cast is brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of crime, in Kildare Street at the capital, a man drives a cement truck through the gates of the Dáil with a sign on the back which reads, "The people have had enough. All politicians have been sacked with immediate effect. Power to the people." I don't know who this guy is, but he's my hero. I hope it was the same guy who reversed the truck through the Russian embassy gates.
Yeah, I'd say someone similar, all right. Or certainly the embassy gates guy got the idea from this. I've sat because I work really close to there now, and I would have loved to have been in work that day. but yeah, this is there was a sustained protests.
Oh yeah,
this was the kickoff of the Dáil at the end of September, and your man drove the truck into the gates, and it was just unheard of, and it led to. It didn't lead to, but it was the start of many protests, and they've continued for years. And still, there still are protests.
Oh,
obviously,
yeah.
Everyone protests for different things, but these were like sustained protests about the austerity measures, the country being sold down the river to the IMF and to the bailout and all the rest of it. And you know, it was an interesting way to start things off.
It was, so up next is quite a bit. So I'm gonna. It's the last segment of the show. Everything falls under the one bracket. And like I said, it's more your area of expertise. So I'll run through what I've got and we can talk about it after. So protests are widespread to mark the return of the Dáil after autumn break. People are pissed over bank bailouts, economic crisis and job losses. International pressure mounts as there is fear of widespread financial collapse across the Eurozone. By the end of the year, we've run out of time and money. As a delegate from the IMF arrives in Dublin, as Miriam O'Callaghan calls it, one of the blackest days of the Irish state. I love the way she phrased that, because calling it the blackest days in Irish history would really overshadow the famine, which was literally a black day. Biffo says that we are to seek bailout options from NAMA, the EU and the IMF, or the back of the couch if it comes to it. In total, the financial rescue package would be worth about 67.5 million. And Pat Rabbit is giving Fianna Fáil's Pat Carey a going in while Pat pretends that he can't hear him. Michael Noonan fires a shot across the bow as the budget is unveiled, and he says it is the budget of a puppet government who are being told what to do by the IMF. Brian Lenihan basically says that we've got to have faith, the faith, the faith. What I will say from this is, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. Am I right in saying that this was the budget that needed a do-over? That they had to, they put it out there, and I think people were so pissed that they were like, right, we'll do it again. And second of all, in your financial opinion, if we don't concede and we don't say, right, we need the help of the IMF, the EU, whoever, NAMA, whatever, would we have eventually made it out on our own?
Okay, so I think the do-over budget was last year.
No, was it?
With all the protests and stuff, but I think this could have been one as well. Yeah, because remember there was all the grey protest deal.
Yeah, you're right, it could have been actually. Yeah, it could have been.
But there probably was several. I mean, certainly the budget would have been heavily influenced by this. And yeah, to answer your second question, no, I don't think so. I think it was inevitable because I think these are last resorts. Like, you don't resort to these bailouts, because I suppose initially the bank bailout in 2008, that ties the future of the country to the prosperity of our banks, which is not ideal, especially when they're failing. And then NAMA, I think, is just a vehicle to try and boost the banks. So that comes directly from that bailout. And then this is really, again, it's to do with that decision in 2008, because the money you're taking from the IMF here, 22.5 billion, I think it is, which you're entitled to take, because Ireland was a long-standing member of the IMF, the IMF's International Monetary Fund. They've been, Ireland, remember, since 1957, had contributed to the fund.
1957? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it works. You become a member of the fund and you contribute to it. So you put money into it. All these countries put money into it. And then where a country needs money from it.
Oh, like a savings scheme.
Yeah, they apply and they get it. So that's all this is. But the problem is like the scale of it, because Ireland is so fucked that we need so much money. It's 22.5 billion as part of the IMF giving 85 billion euro to different EU states. So like, you know, Greece, Spain, and all the rest of it. And we were using the money. So the plan here was that we were going to look at the banks that were going to be able to be restored in some way over the long term. So get rid of the ones like Anglo-Irish that weren't, that were toxic, put the money into the banks. So that would allow them to then have a bit of stability and start selling their banking products, and therefore getting people to put money back into the bank. And part of the money then was to also strengthen the regulation and the you know, put people training in place and people in place to make sure that what had happened in Celtic Tiger wasn't going to happen again. So it was an absolute, like, it needed to be done. You don't do it unless you need to do it. It needed to be done. Now, could maybe this government have taken a different tack in 2008? Possibly. They could have let the banks fail, but it's probably impossible even now to say exactly what would have happened there. Things could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
But it all stems from that bailout decision in 2008. Everything just flows from that then. So this was inevitable once they made that decision in 2008.
Yeah. I think it's just like, looking back on these episodes is very, I won't say difficult, but like, you know, you're kind of putting yourself in that position again. And it kind of makes you want, like what if, like, I've always wondered, like genuinely, like, what if, because there's always that running joke, right, of like the world has a combined debt of X amount of billion or trillion or whatever. It's like, who the hell do we owe money to? Aliens? But, you know, like, it's like, right, what happens, like, if a country is like, like, what happens if we just decided, you know, okay, we're financially screwed. No, we'll get through this. Like, we don't need any we don't need any assistance from the IMF, from NAMA, whatever. And we just decide to go it alone. Like, obviously, no government in their right mind is going to say, no, we're fine. We'll do it, whatever. But like, but it would be interesting to see in a kind of a crystal ball situation where, like, give me 10 years from 2010 where Ireland decided to go alone. What the hell happens? Are we living in tents on roundabouts through, in the middle of an unfinished M6, you know, or do we end up persevering? Like, you know, it's just, It's interesting to see where we would be without this assistance. Although I love the way now the IMF to me is now just a big massive credit union.
That's essentially what it is. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's probably someone far smarter than me who certainly there are people far smarter than me, but there's probably someone who could theoretically do a study on that and come up with a theory and flesh it out. It would make for an interesting documentary, I think.
Oh yeah.
And I would be surprised if we didn't see one at some point in the coming years. Maybe the 20th anniversary of this kind of thing, usually. And just somebody playing devil's advocate and saying what would have happened. It's all conjecture. It's like anything, butterfly effect. Like once one decision is made, it things change.
Oh, yeah.
You can't really say with any great certainty what would have happened if you hadn't made that decision. But it definitely would have been interesting to see what would have happened. The country would have gone bankrupt. That is a fact.
That's a given.
So, you know, I think we certainly would have been worse off.
Oh yeah, 100%. I can forecast that one.
But nobody, you know, hard to say what it'd be like now. Yeah. You know,
definitely Eddie Hobbs has that somewhere on a flow chart in one of his houses.
100%. Yeah,
100%. So with that out of the way, that is going to do it for our 2010 episode. So before we go, what we'd like to do is go around the table. Well, it's not much of a table, it's just myself and Simon. But we would like to discuss if we were to take any three people from tonight's episode, bring them to a dinner party, who would they be and why? So, Simon, what three people from tonight would you pick?
Okay, so first man I'm going to get in has to be Man Slipping on Ice.
Oh, yes.
I mean, this guy... Never before has one man become so well known through such a small clip.
Through the back of his head.
Yeah, and I think he's probably the first viral sensation or meme, maybe. Not meme, meme's the wrong word, but you know what I mean? Like that kind of like clip. GIF maybe is the word I'm looking for. But so he's definitely coming. I wonder, is his head still sore? I'll bring him in. And then I'm also going to bring Charlie Bird.
Yeah.
This is obviously more... Obviously, he was a crusading journalist, and we saw him there, like, not afraid to go and track this guy. I know it's only a banker, but, like, go and track him down and, you know, ask him the questions. And he felt, you know, you could tell there, he feels like he's representing the nation. He wants answers. That's a journalist, you know, that's what it should be, especially when you're working for the national broadcaster. We don't always get that. So, and obviously then, like, everything that's gone on recently with Charlie, he's been inspirational and you know, his attitude to his diagnosis and... what he's going through is fantastic. So I would definitely bring Charlie Bird. And then the third person I'm going to bring is Mairead Corrigan McGuire, who we saw on the boat, the MV Rachel Corrie. Again, a past hero of previous episodes, and just seems an all around good skin and someone who's devoted her life to helping bring peace and try and bring change and try and help people. So I'm going to bring her as well.
Good stuff. So we had one in common there. I picked Slippy Iceman.
It has to be done.
I would pick, if possible, one or both of the Rubber Bandits, just because I think they've done a lot to put Ireland on the map, just in terms of fringe comedy and fringe music. Like the way they took a stand as well against BBC because they subtitled them. Just niche shit like that. It just always gets me. And finally, I would pick Enthusiastically Disappointed Man from Leitrim. Just because he seems like great crack. Like he seems like you tell him, like he's like the anti-Father Stone. You tell him like, oh, it's raining outside. He'd be like, oh, jeez, rain. Fuck, jeez, I wouldn't have predicted that at all. You know, just a man who tries to make the best out of life. So that would be my dinner party. So thank you very much once again to everybody out there listening to us. As always, we try our best to bring you a weekly or bi-weekly episode. And I hope you've enjoyed listening. This is the beginning of the end, essentially. We're coming close. We're on 2010. So we've got another 8 episodes, essentially, left. And then we shall... Well, we'll see what the future brings. But for now, thank you as always for listening. A huge thank you to my Twitter expert and co-host and financial analyst and all things rugby and all things sport analyst, Simon Jadwick. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Kieran. My remit is expanding as we go through the sessions. So,
put that on your CV. And a big thank you to everybody out there listening. And you know what? Especially a huge, I suppose, a kind of a well done pat on the back, fair play to one of the characters in tonight's episode, Charlie Bird. I agree with everything what you said. The man is making the best of an awful situation, and he is completely 100% inspirational to everybody suffering with the same thing, and also those of us who may not be, but also just an absolute legend is Charlie Bird. We wish him the very best for the future. So once again, thanks to everybody for listening this evening. We'll be back next week with the year 2011. So as always, keep on reeling.
Now when I return, though my eyes they are burned to see how a town could be brought to its knees by the armored cars and the bombed out bars and the gas that hangs on to every breeze. Now the army's installed by that old gas yard wall, and the down barbed wire is higher and higher with their tanks and their guns. Oh my God, to the town that I love so well.
And again, I would suggest that